Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. We're running a little shorthanded today. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz. And then we have the empty chair.
The empty chair, where the one and only John Steinbacher would be sitting. But he's a little under the weather this week, so he's sitting this one out. We'll have to just soldier on, Lisa, do the best we can.
Yep. He could have Skyped in, but whatever. That guy, he's just lazy. So anyway, we're going to start off today just talking. We're going to do the rivalry, like, right away.
Yeah.
We still need, like, rivalry theme music. I'm trying to think of, like.
I've got something I've been playing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I did miss it.
Sometimes I don't listen to all of us. I have to confess. I know. I can't, because I've already lived it, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean anybody listening shouldn't complete the whole thing, because we're pretty great. So, but anyway, my rivalry this time is a rivalry in a sport that sometimes I make fun of and say, how can this possibly be a sport? And I'm not trying to offend anybody. And this is a golf rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, when I say golf, a lot of people will say Tiger Woods, mm-hmm. or Phil Mickelson or whatever. And so more recent, like, players where there may have been some kind of rivalry where they're trying to beat each other, but it wasn't necessarily the same as this rivalry that I'm going to talk about. And actually, it's an unusual rivalry because it involves three people,
mm-hmm.
three different people. One of the people is involved in two rivalries.
Yeah.
So the first rivalry, which I don't really remember as much from my childhood, is between the great golfer Arnold Palmer and the equally great golfer Jack Nicklaus, who was a little bit of a young upstart that came in and sort of upset the Arnold Palmer apple cart.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a kid, a little kid, and probably, I don't know if I ever remember seeing Arnold Palmer play golf, like, with this rivalry with Jack Nicklaus, but they always talked about it. And
mm-hmm.
And I just remember thinking it was funny, like, these guys, even as a little kid, it's like these guys aren't even playing against each other. It's not like combat or wrestling or, you know, they're basically a team of one playing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jack Nicklaus was this young upstart that came in, and he and Arnold Palmer enjoyed quite the rivalry for 15 years or so, I think.
Yeah.
And then until the late 70s, or, you know, maybe very late 70s. And then right around the same time, Jack Nicklaus is at the top of the world, pinnacle of golf. And then here comes this other guy, also a, you know, younger guy coming in, as Tom Watson,
mm-hmm.
who won a couple of tournaments and very close golf matches in the late 70s from Jack Nicklaus. But I would say the key, like, it's on, like, Donkey Kong kind of moment was when Tom Watson won the U.S. Open in 1982. Against Jack Nicklaus, and we'll have a clip of, like, the shot. It's pretty amazing, actually. And they were already congratulating Jack Nicklaus at the 18th hole, like, you've done it again, you've won your fifth Masters or U.S. Open or whatever. And then Tom Watson does this, like, almost sort of impossible thing. And the thing I noticed when I was watching the video was, like, you know, sometimes now in golf, players take forever to do their putt.
Mm-hmm.
literally minutes. They're walking around. They're consulting with their caddy. They're swinging 1,000 times. And the lead up to this, I was shocked when he actually hit the ball. I thought for sure it was just going to keep going on. So that's, like, maybe one thing that's maybe changed a little bit in golf. But anyway, he just gets right in there, chips it in. Basically, that wins it for him. And that so that sort of kicked off this rivalry, again, featuring Jack Nicklaus, but this time with Tom Watson, which I thought was really interesting. And I just wonder how Jack Nicklaus felt when that went in and he could hear at the next hole. Like, everybody's freaking out on the 17th hole and he's at the 18th hole. I just thought that was kind of interesting. You know, I wasn't really that much into golf as a kid. My brother is an avid golfer. And was a caddy starting at the age of, like, 7 at Hazeltine National Golf Club, and was a huge golf fan. And maybe if we ever want to talk about golf, we could probably bring him in to talk about golf. But I think that this particular rivalry for me was a case of definitely a rivalry making a sport more interesting, these two guys, you know, Sundays when I couldn't, when baseball wasn't on because for some reason there was a golf tournament on, if those guys were playing, it was always on in our house because it was interesting. Mm-hmm. They were trying to outsmart each other and trying to outplay each other. And with golf, there's so much other stuff that's sort of in the mix with the weather and conditions of the course and all that stuff. But it really was one of those things where it was like golf kind of needs those kinds of rivalries. And I'm not sure they really have those anymore. I'm not even sure. I mean, I guess Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson maybe had a rivalry, but Tiger Woods was so dominant that it was like there was no rivalry mm-hmm. for a while.
Yeah,
it's
interesting to me. It almost seems that Tiger Woods' biggest rivalry was with himself
yes.
in a lot of ways.
Totally.
Both on and off the course.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's ultimately kind of what brought him down. But I came of sporting age a little bit later than you did. Not a lot, but enough later that I never really saw Nicklaus and Watson play against each other in their primes. I mean, I saw mm-hmm. it later on, and certainly I remember announcers talking about it a lot. It seemed especially at the British Open because that was mm-hmm. kind of Watson's event for
yes.
several years where I think he won four or five British Opens.
He won five, and he almost won a sixth and would have been the oldest guy to have done. This was just a few, like maybe 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But my lasting memory of Jack Nicklaus was in the Masters in 1986, Jack was well past his prime at that point. He hadn't won a tournament in, I think, 2, 3, 4 years, something like that, a tournament of any kind. And here we get to Sunday at the Masters, and he's on the leaderboard, but he's a ways back. He isn't that close to the lead. He had guys like Greg Norman and Seve Ballesteros
right.
who were you know, at the lead of the event, and all of a sudden, on the back nine of the Masters, here comes Jack Nicklaus, starts making birdie after birdie after birdie, and it was like for one afternoon, he had just kind of summoned up
right.
the greatness that he'd had for so long. And
yeah.
I remember watching that as a kid and just being absolutely mesmerized. And I don't know if we'll quite see anything like that again, but that's kind of my lasting memory of Jack.
Well, and thinking just about rivalry in golf, I mean, now college golf, especially living here and you know, where the University of Illinois has a really good golf team, and then starting to see commercials on a variety of sports channels for college golf tournament competition, and you know, somebody wins and they dump a cooler over, you know, the guys, and they're all wearing like their plaid shorts and their polo shirts, and it's so there's now these they're trying to build up these rivalries between college teams, and so I wonder. You know, it's not exactly the same as player versus player rivalry, but I could see, like, as golf as a team sport, you know, maybe even at the college level, I saw that, oh, yeah, maybe, you know, I'm not even sure who the best golf teams are in the country at the college level, but I could see it being sort of a grudge match every year for certain teams that wouldn't necessarily translate over to those teams, football or basketball, more traditional rivalries, because the sports are so different, and mm-hmm. you know, team schools that may not have really any sort of traction in basketball or football might have an amazing golf team. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and this again, I'm like you. My knowledge of college golf is a little limited, but as you might expect with a sport like golf, the better teams tend to be in warmer weather places because they can
right.
play year round. So mm-hmm. a lot of teams in the Southeastern Conference, Atlantic Coast Conference, the Pac-12 out west are often very good at golf. That tends to be kind of the norm. Illinois this year, for instance, lost to Oregon in the semifinals
right.
of their tournament. That was on Oregon's home course. But you had teams like USC and Texas,
sure,
and kind of the usual suspects in mm-hmm. in that regard. It seems as I kind of was looking up and down the leaderboard on those tournaments, it was like, well, you know, I'm not really shocked to see a lot of these names here. Maybe the one that makes sense for golf that isn't all that good in other sports was Vanderbilt, was up on
sure.
the leaderboard.
Right.
They're not known for...
Totally makes sense for golf,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, college golf, very, very interesting in that regard. And I could see some of those rivalries developing.
And I think at some point we'll have to address golf itself as a sport and who plays and who gets to play and who doesn't get to play, or how is the sport marketed to young people of color? Is this, you know, what about women's golf? We haven't even gone there. You know, I actually remember watching many women's golf tournaments in my youth. Why were we watching so much golf when I was a kid?
That's what was on.
What is the deal? Well, and also you didn't have like 9 billion channels or streams or whatever to watch. If I want to watch soccer all the time, by God, I can do it. And we do. But back then it was just like, well, I guess I'll watch Nancy Lopez or, you know, whoever play golf. And, you know, but I am curious. I think someday we'll have to address, like, you know, because when I look at all these golf teams, and Tiger Woods is obviously, excuse me, an obvious exception, but most of the players are white. And it is not, you know, course time is not cheap. And it's just, it's interesting to me.
Yeah, we can certainly delve into that. I had a little different experience growing up in small town Iowa. We had a local municipal golf course, and it was not expensive to play. But the demographics of small town Iowa certainly are not the same as demographics of inner city Chicago. So it's, there's a lot of different aspects to that.
Well, yeah, in Chaska, Minnesota, where my brother and I grew up. So there's Hazeltine National Golf Course, which, or club, which is right there. And then, but they had this, like, was it? It was a nine-hole course. Would a par 30 be about right for a nine-hole course?
Well, yeah.
I can't remember what we used to call it. I worked there one summer, just sort of given.
Yeah, there are different types. I mean, there are nine-hole courses that are what they call par 3 courses, where all the holes are par 3s.
Okay.
They're not long holes, so you can just work on your short game,
your
irons and your putting. And then there are just regular nine-hole courses that are essentially like regular golf courses, just half as many holes.
Yeah, I can't remember what this one was like. But there was an option, like if you, you know, my brother delivered newspapers. So when he wasn't caddying and delivering newspapers, he would like play golf at this little course. But, you know, and again, the demographics of far suburban Minneapolis, St. Paul at that time certainly were not, were predominantly white, sort of reasonably middle class people playing golf. So, but I think now I'm curious now, like how the sport is marketed to young people in general, as potential players. And so, yeah, good topic of conversation for the future.
Consider that a tease for a future bandwagon
tease,
segment.
A T-E-E-S tease. Huh? I see what I did there.
Yeah. Very nice.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about, just really briefly. So we hinted in the last episode that the United States women's soccer team, women's national team, was sort of tinkering with the idea of striking before the Rio Olympics. There's been there's a couple different labor disputes. This one is different than the one where the players filed a lawsuit before the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. Equal
EEOC.
EEOC, not EOEC. And so this one is a little bit different. What I think is interesting, so it got struck down by a judge just a few days ago. So they're not going to strike. And in fact, they can't do anything like that until after the first of the year. And the January 1st, 2017 is the first day that they could actually strike. But basically their complaints are myriad, and I think they're valid. You know, the issues include playing on artificial turf. Men only play on grass. Now in the NASL, you know, they occasionally play on turf, but the guys at the world level, like when you're talking about like World Cup, Olympics, stuff like that, they are playing on grass. The women played their World Cup on artificial turf, and there were a lot of complaints and photos of turf burn and stuff like that. Another complaint is, you know, just when they travel, they all fly coach. The men always fly business class, whatever. I can see that being important. Pay structure is different based on the number of points that you get when you win in World Cup games, and the women are not. The men are paid that way. The women are not. So anyway, they're not going to strike, but they're not happy. My daughter and I, she's a former high school soccer player who follows the game quite closely, and she was telling me stories about how in other countries it's equally a slog for these teams. In England, one of their best players was homeless for a while. In other countries, a lot of people don't think women should be playing sports at all, so they don't get any support, you know. And so she's not saying that the U.S. women's national team shouldn't complain. I think they have a legitimate case. But women's sports in general are still so far behind. And part of it for me is I think in a lot of cases the guys are making the decisions. And the men's game is still held up as like the thing that all people should aspire to play. And so if women don't play like men, then it's not worth watching. I mean, if you wander into the r soccer subreddit on reddit.com, it's really hard for a lady to be in there sometimes, you know. But the other thing that surprised me is the lack of press that this whole thing has gotten. I kind of had to dig around. Part of it is there's a lot of soccer going on right now. The Euros are about to start. The Copa America is happening right now, men's games. So, and the Olympic stuff is coming. So this kind of got lost in the shuffle, which, again, it's like incredibly – it seems incredibly dismissive to me.
Yeah, I would agree. And the other part that these players brought up, and I think very appropriately so, is that the women's national team draws equal or bigger audiences
yes.
as the men's team, equal or bigger crowds in a lot of cases as the men's team.
Mm-hmm.
And they get paid a lot less, which does not seem fair in the least.
No, it's not. And, you know, it's I remember like when remember a bajillion years ago when like the very first time that Major League Baseball went on strike. And I was like I was a little kid. And I'm like, how can they go on strike? Because you just always thought it was like, you know, people who worked in mines were going on strike or whatever. And so sports as labor, you know, was something that I first learned about when I was a kid. And so as I've followed over time, you know, yes, when you see how much money these women are making for soccer and how much they're doing for soccer in this country, paying them better and not forcing them to play on artificial turf, which is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard on your body.
Yeah.
It's not just about turf burn. It's about knees and ankles and heads and those weird little rubber pellets that they put in there that I'm still finding in my house now. You know, it's just gross. They should play on grass, you know. So that, among other things. So, and get paid better. I mean, why not? Why would you want to, you know, it's really great to be all like, USA, we love our women's team, woohoo. But then at the same time, you're forcing them to play in conditions that really are not, you would never ask your men's team to play in. Okay, and it is time once again for our segment. We don't really have a frequency for this segment necessarily that we call Better Tate Than Never. And Travis Tate is here to join us. He offers his perspective as a sports guy, former PR in sports kind of person, talking about a wide variety of things. And today we brought him in because we want him to talk about the D-League, which I think is probably the worst name for a league in sports because you think, well, if you're me, you think A-League, B-League, C-League. Oh, now we're down to the D-League. D-League actually stands for Development League for the NBA. And Travis worked for a team for several years, and he's here to offer his perspective today. And our homework for everybody here was to listen to the recent Embedded podcast episode where a couple of NPR sports guys followed two players for a team in the D-League. And so that was the homework assignment. We've all done the homework. We've sorted that out. So welcome, Travis.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Great to be back.
Yeah.
As the saying goes, been there, done that. Got the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got my Idaho Stampede Taco Bell branded black T-shirt.
You can't see the Taco Bell part from the front, but it's there.
No.
So, but yeah, that's a styling T-shirt. So, All right. So let's start a little bit. Maybe just can you give some background about where you were and what exactly it was you were doing?
So I worked for the Idaho Stampede, which is why I was able to get a T-shirt at some point. The Idaho Stampede are based out of Boise, Idaho, or were. When I was there, they were in the NBA D League. They were also in the CBA, which is the Continental Basketball Association, for a while. The team was started up in, I think, about 1996 or 7 or so. They were playing most of their games either in downtown Boise or in Nampa, which is basically a suburb of Boise. Locally owned by a bunch of big basketball fans that wanted to start a team. Then they made it to the NBA D League when the D League started up in whatever year that was. I think they joined the league in about 2006. I was there for three basketball seasons. About 3 years ago was my last time with them. And yeah, it was a pretty great experience. I mean, in terms of it being it sort of gave you a good idea of all of the business side of sports because the front office to a minor league basketball team is very, very small mm-hmm. as compared to, mm-hmm. say, a full-on NBA team.
Well, I wanted to ask you, like, before we get into the players and the one thing that struck me in the podcast when I was listening to the episode was there was just a very short snippet where the Travis of their team, their PR guy, was like on the bus telling him, pick up your trash.
I made a note here with some exclamation points. To have a PR person traveling with the team, mm-hmm. as far as I know, is unheard of in the D-League. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that, never seen that.
You never got to.
That was not even on the table. That was not a conversation we were ever going to have. You can only, buy so many plane tickets for these guys. I mean, they're already trying to save as much money as possible. This is truly like a much smaller operation than, definitely smaller than the NBA, definitely smaller than big level college. It's probably closer to like junior college or maybe like D2 or whatever they call D2 now. So I sort of made a note of that. I did hear that Sean Wyatt, who works for the Canton Charge, is their PR guy. I mean, I'm glad he got to travel, I guess. I mean, it's not that great to go to like Sioux Falls and then have to get on a bus and go down to Bismarck if you're doing that.
Sure.
That's kind of like famous in the D-League for how terrible the travel is.
But so in the PR part of the D-League, like, are the PR people trying to get called up to the majors too? I mean, how is somebody doing the job that you were doing? What's their goal? Are they trying to get called up by the Celtics or the Bulls or
whoever? Yeah. So one of the that was actually one of the first questions that I got from, and we'll talk about him, I'm sure, for just a little bit. Antoine Walker, when he started with the team, he had been this longtime NBA star. He was a 3-time All-Star. He made $100 million or whatever, and I'm driving him, in my 2004 Toyota to this community event somewhere where we had to get on the interstate, and we drove in the car for a while, and he kind of asked at one point, like, hey, I'm in the D-League, but, like, you're in the D-League too, so does that mean you're trying to get called up? And I said, everybody in the D-League is trying to get called up in one way or another. Maybe, like, the team president might not want to because of his responsibilities and things. He's able to do a little bit more. Plus, he was a little more like just settled as like an adult human being. Most of the front office staff in terms of like the ticket sales guys, PR guys are going to be very, very young. So I was even slightly older than mm-hmm. like our ticket sales guys, but I'm talking about like a year or two.
Right.
So for the most part, everybody wants to go up. Yeah.
When you were listening to the podcast and to the players' stories, I mean, were those relatable to you in terms of some of the conversations or that you might have had with some of the players, or things that you heard about happening in the league?
Yeah, I mean, so the players. I mean, I didn't interact with them all day, every day. But, of course, everybody knows that the players desperately want to make it to the NBA. I mean, that's even more for them than for me because they are so much more – they're like ramblers. They go year by year. They're going to do whatever they think is best for them at that time in terms of, do I try to play overseas? Do I try to play in Asia? Do I try to play in the D-League? Those are very difficult decisions that they have to make. I'm glad they had a good example of somebody like a Mike Dunnigan, who's one of the subjects of that Embedded podcast. And he was a guy who sounds like was able to make quite a bit of money in Asia and some other European countries in his, five or so year long career. And, and then he's done that. So he thinks, well, maybe I'm pretty set financially. Let's try to go for it in the D-League. I'm still only 26. That's about middle age for trying to make it the very first time. So, I did feel bad for him that he didn't end up making it. Sorry, spoiler alert. But
and I guess that was another question I had is why some of these guys, when they can play overseas, they're playing the Philippines or they're playing Europe or wherever, and they can make a bunch of money. Why would they keep trying to come back to the NBA when they're going to be stuck in a Sioux Falls or a Bismarck?
We
can talk more about that also in a minute. But, it's got to be pretty powerful if you're walking away from money, especially at a young age, and especially in a, you know, as we saw or listened to with Mike Dunnigan, there's a reason why he didn't make it. And, I mean, there were probably several, but there was one specific reason, and that is injury, and that can happen anywhere. And so I was fascinated by this, like, constant going back trying to make it. And yeah. what does that mean? You ride the bench like that one other guy, you know, and you just sit there and you make $25,000 in a year. Yeah, you don't dress, but they give you a nice white Mercedes to drive around.
That's pretty nice.
It is nice, but that's not what
the dream is.
They're not playing basketball every day.
But I guess the first part of that dream is, I mean, you can't play in the NBA until you're on the roster in the NBA.
Sure.
And so the first step to playing is getting on the roster and then using that to hopefully catch on, if not with the Celtics as with this player, maybe with another team the following year, et cetera, et cetera.
And the other thing, so when you, it's so like the league generally is much more about those kinds of relationships than a lot of people realize, like being able to say that you were coached by whoever the assistants were that were working out Mike Dunnigan, or sorry, who's the guy that made the that actually made the Celtics?
Holland?
John Holland.
John
yes.
Holland.
Yeah.
So when John Holland is working out pregame for those last two games of the year, he's developing relationships with very important assistant coaches.
Oh, totally.
You never know where those assistant coaches are going to end up.
Sure.
They might be a guy who's able to hire him on as a player later, maybe as a coach. I mean, it's so much more just about getting to know those people, and you got to get on the roster in order to meet them. So it's kind of like that chicken before the egg thing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about affiliation. I was just glancing at the, you know, the D-League standings here for this year, and I see that, that all the teams, except for two of them, have a listed NBA affiliate with them. There's two teams here, the Bakersfield Jam and the Idaho Stampede, that don't have an affiliate listed. When you were with the Stampede, were they affiliated with a particular NBA team?
So actually, what you're looking at must be old or something, because the Idaho Stampede no longer exists.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They were – so I'll try to answer a couple questions there. The Idaho Stampede are now the Salt Lake City Stars, and they are located in Salt Lake City as of – an announcement that came out like 2 months ago, I think.
Okay.
The Idaho Stampede front office, they were all let go.
Wow.
That was
so
all,
they didn't
like
move everybody with
no,
them? They
no.
just, it was just cut and dried. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
As far as the affiliations go, so when I was in the league, and they've even, they continue to add more and more teams every year. The idea is to get it so that it's a one-on-one relationship. So that there are 32 teams in the NBA. And that they would hopefully have 32 D-League teams. There aren't 32 D-League teams right now. I think there are maybe like 20 or so. So there's going to be certain teams with that one-on-one relationship. A good example might be, say, the San Antonio Spurs and then the Austin. For a long time, they were called the Austin Toros, but now they're called the Austin Spurs. So, yeah, that one-on-one relationship, that obviously means that there are going to be other teams that don't have any one-on-one relationship, and therefore they kind of feed to multiple teams is basically how that works. So when I was with the Stampede for two of the years, we had like two and then three parent clubs. So we were dealing with the Denver Nuggets, the Portland Trail Blazers, and the Utah Jazz. And then the next year it was just only – like Denver wasn't included. And then we got into a one-on-one relationship with Portland. And so we had a three-year contract to be the full-on feeding club with the Portland Trailblazers. That only lasted 2 years. They got out of that deal. And then we got a new deal with the Utah Jazz. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just to follow up on that, they apparently didn't change the team name and the standings for Idaho.
Yeah.
Because I click through and I get to a Salt Lake City splash landing page
from
that. So just a weird quirk of the D-League page there.
Yeah.
So I have a question about the fans. So when you were with Idaho, and maybe talking a little bit about the D-League in general, so when we're listening to the Embedded podcast about the league, There's some action from the games. There's like people calling play by play. You know, what is the fan base like? What was attendance like at games? Were people really into it? You did hear people asking players for autographs and being recognized in the grocery store. And so I'm definitely curious to know what that was like and how it compares maybe to other minor league sports that may have a different fan base, a different type of fan base.
Yeah, my big comparison is always when you're talking minor league sports is always going to be with minor league baseball, just because that has like such like a, I don't know, it's made an impact, I guess, on any number of communities in the entire United States for 100 years or however long minor league baseball has existed. The fan base in Idaho, I mean, every team is going to have their super fans for sure, whether that's high rollers who get the corporate boxes or that's just folks who buy tickets to occasional games. So there's always going to be kind of those people who really want to know what's going on with the team. It's a little harder to make an impact with kind of the little more lackadaisical fan or, Joe Sixpack on the street. They aren't guaranteed to be coming to all the games or even know about what's going on with the team. The media coverage for our situation was pretty reliable. We had a good relationship with the Idaho Statesman, which is the main newspaper in the state of Idaho. And we did have it's not a television broadcast, but we had essentially a television broadcast. It was streamed over YouTube to be able to watch the games real time. So we had kind of the things you think of in terms of, hey, this is a professional sports team. Like, do they have this, this, and this? Yes, we do, but probably on a smaller scale.
Yeah, it's like the U.S., the National Women's Soccer League in the United States. A lot of their teams have YouTube streams that you access to watch their games. They don't because they're not carried really on any on any.
And
station.
Like for instance, we had a radio broadcast of the game for many, many years. We eventually went away from that, and I mean, we just didn't work out.
Craziest promotion or events or any or things along those lines that you were involved in with the Stampede?
We didn't have the kind of stuff like I think that you'd be thinking of with baseball where you can, you know, dress up as whoever and get in for free or something. But I did tell this story in that email chain with you guys about Rumble, who's our mascot, our much beloved. He kind of looks like a muskrat or
I was going to ask, like, what is a Rumble?
He was a creature? A wolf, maybe?
Kind.
I think he was
is
a
Is that
wolf?
What's on your...
No. So no, the Idaho Stampede logo has like a bucking bronco.
Okay, yeah.
Stallion.
Weird.
Of sorts. Well, it's out in the West, you know.
No, I gotcha.
Big horse community, I guess. But so Rumble was a, like I said, he was like a
muskrat.
He really did look like kind of like a dirty rat. I don't know. He didn't look too hot.
A coyote or some such thing.
Coyote. Maybe he was a coyote. Yeah.
Maybe.
It's sad I can't even remember.
I'm just kind of reaching for things that could be.
I mean, those are all good guesses. I think maybe he was a coyote. I really can't believe I don't remember this. But anyway, so Rumble exists. And one day we figure out that we're going to have a new sponsorship. And so that's kind of what kind of maybe getting at what you're asking, like crazy stuff you can do is basically we'll put a name on anything, including the mascot, Rumble, who was AAA Rumble, as in like AAA, you know, you call when your
tire
blows out or something.
Yeah. Car service, yeah.
So he was AAA Rumble for a while, which of course just doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. And so we decided the next year, maybe not decided, we were able to sell the next year a new name for Rumble, which is on the back of my T-shirt, and that is Taco Bell Rumble. So Rumble
every year
was
something different.
Yeah,
AAA
I don't know what
Rumble,
it was after that.
Taco
it might
Bell
have changed.
Rumble.
Yeah, it could have gone to Taco John's or some other competing taco company. I don't know.
Oh, dear. So you guys are busily trying to, you know, get the fan base going and get everybody excited. And the team wants to win and the players want to win, the coaches, the fans. But one thing that you brought up that I thought was really interesting is that the NBA team does not care.
Yeah.
They do not care.
I don't
think
they should.
That's got to be weird, though. Like when you're a player or you're part of a team and you just know that it doesn't really mean anything at all to the ultimate team or goal.
The higher up. So, I mean, just to use a name, just to put a face on it, I guess, Neil Olshey is the GM for the Portland Trail Blazers. He's done many, many great things. Portland had a shockingly, surprisingly great season this year. They ended up making the playoffs when they were supposed to win like 15 games. He was in Los Angeles with the Clippers before and helped get Chris Paul. So he is a very accomplished guy. Neil Olshey, when he is thinking about the Portland Trail Blazers, doesn't care two hoots, I wouldn't imagine, about the Idaho Stampede win and loss record.
Right.
He wants to see, hey, who are the 13th, 14th, and 15th guys on our roster? Should we send them down to Idaho to just be able to get on the floor, you know, get to play, get some minutes, and see if they can develop a little bit? Whether or not they win or lose, that doesn't matter. The more important thing probably is, like, any kind of injury. Like, he would be wondering, hey, if I send them to Idaho, is there any possibility for injury? Do they have any kind of lingering, you know, knee or shoulder thing or something? But it definitely does. I think people would be surprised to hear that, but I mean, not really if you think about it.
Sure. No.
We were surprised, I guess, or maybe our ownership was surprised.
I guess what surprised me about it was not so much if a team is doing well, that means there are players who are playing well, right? So if you have a team that's 0-15, you know, if it were me, just on the face of it, it would be like, man, these guys suck. And, like, there's nobody who can carry this team. No one's doing anything, even though that's not true. When you go into basketball or any sport, people are contributing. They're putting points on the board. They're assisting. They're playing great defense, whatever it is. So to me, in my simple little analytical brain, when we're thinking about this, at first blush, it's like, well, I'm surprised that an NBA front office or staff or whoever don't really care, because if a team is doing well, then the implication is that there are players that they can bring up.
And so, I mean, I am kind of overstating it. Of course, they want the team to do well. Like, they own that minor league team. It's not like they're celebrating when the D-League team loses. But I think
well, that's good.
They care much more about the individual players who are going to be able to help them.
Sure, and that makes sense.
So it, and I'm also looking at it from the point of view of the NBA team, where they are in the position to be able to send guys down. Any NBA team can call up any NBA D-League player who doesn't already have a contract with – so let's say Portland has Myers Leonard and they want to send him down to the D-League. When he's in the D-League, he can't get claimed by, say, the Chicago Bulls or somebody. But any other player who's on a D-League contract – can get called up by any NBA team. So if you are playing great for the Reno Bighorns and, you know, they have an affiliation, I think, with the Sacramento Kings, if you're like the New York Knicks, you know, so as far away as you can get, they're like, you know, we really want this guy. We know him. We know about him. We know his agent. They're going to swoop him up.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Reno Bighorns.
Yeah,
Reno Bighorns mention.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the dream, you know, getting called up by the NBA. Travis Tate joining us for Better Tate Than Never. Travis, thanks for your perspective. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
And finally today, another look at what grabbed our attention on social media this week. Lisa, why don't we start with you on this?
Okay, so I have two small things. One is I have a new favorite person in women's tennis, and her name is Garbiñe Muguruza. No one can say her name right, I think. Like, when you go to the pronunciation thing online, it's like, no, this is not right.
Yeah, when I looked it up really the other strange. Day, I saw Magurtha, like with the TH, like a Spanish
Magurtha,
S.
Magurtha, yeah, Magurtha. Like that. But that's not how you're supposed to say it, actually.
Okay.
So I just say Muguruza, and my apologies to anybody that I may offend, but she played she's just got really great social media presence on Instagram and Twitter, and not to mention the fact that she played an amazing match that ended in such an anticlimactic way. She just kind of lobbed the ball as sort of a last-ditch thing, and Serena let it go, but it hit the line, and that's how she won, and everybody was standing around going, was it in, was it out? So anyway, she's a young player to watch. She was believe the fourth seed in the tournament, and she ended up winning. So that was great. Really great person to look up on social media. So there's that. The other thing that I noticed, it wasn't a kerfuffle in any way. It was actually something nice that got pointed out by a writer named Brian Doan, who posted an archived piece from, I believe, 1979, when Roger Ebert went to go watch Rocky II with Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
Did you read that?
Yes, it was marvelous.
Oh, my gosh. It was, first of all, Roger Ebert, I mean, the dude can just tell a story, like, in such a understated and Midwestern and funny kind of way. And so that was great. I loved the way that he recorded Ali's reactions to
some of the things happening in the film, like you can tell that's acting. But that guy in the red shorts in the background, he's a real boxer. You can tell, you know. And my favorite quote, which I posted on our Twitter feed, on the Bandwagon's Twitter feed, that master of disaster. I like that. I wish I'd thought of that. I was like, really? That didn't come from Muhammad Ali. It just sounds like something he'd say, you know. But anyway, that was a really, really nice piece to go back to. You know, Ali has been sick for, you know, quite a while, in and out of the hospital. So when they said that he was back in and was on life support, you knew it wasn't going to be good. So it was really nice to find somebody unearth that piece, and which I had never read before. And I just thought it was fantastic. So it was actually a really nice thing to see on social media.
Yeah, definitely. The thing that caught my eye, and I'm sure this will be resolved by the time that we post the episode this week. But a little bit of, I don't, drama is not even really the right word.
Just I like kerfuffle.
Yeah, kerfuffle, confusion maybe. In Monday night's Cubs game, one of the Cubs outfielders pulled a hamstring and may or may not be put on the disabled list today, depending on the results of an MRI. Well, there was a tweet this morning sent by a guy named Dan Vogelbach. Dan is a AAA first baseman for the Iowa Cubs. And if this other Cubs outfielder, Jorge Soler, is put on the disabled list, one of Vogelbach's teammates, a pretty highly touted prospect named Albert Almora, may get called up to the major leagues to take Soler's spot on the roster.
Mm-hmm.
So Dan Vogelbach, one of his teammates, tweeted out a congratulatory tweet to Albert Almora for getting promoted to the major leagues. And lots of other Chicago media were retweeting this, and it was getting circulated around.
And so on, and so on, and so on. Yeah.
The only problem is that as of the time we're talking here, the MRI on Soler's hamstring hadn't happened yet. So he hasn't been placed on the disabled list, so there's no roster opening for Albert Almora, so he may or may not be on the major league team. So then there were a bunch of, you know, backtracking, oh, wait a second, you know, he's not really called up yet, et cetera, et cetera. So just one of those social media things that happens from time to time.
And so, yeah, but I feel like there's a chance for it to happen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like somebody thinks it's okay to talk about something, but it's not. And then they spill the beans, but they don't even realize they're spilling the beans. And it's like, delete, delete, delete. But by the time you do that, it's like too late because – or then they notice the deletion. They're like, hey, this tweet's been deleted. What's that all about? Here's what it said. Here's a screenshot. Here's – there's just so many
– and that's what's happened. Vogelbach has deleted his tweets,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, my gosh. What a mess. You know, and it's – I mean – you know, I think about, like, we're just talking about sports. Happens all the time in entertainment, politics, you name it. So, well, social media, what a crazy thing. But then again, without it, we probably wouldn't have much of a podcast, to be honest. We get a lot of our information through social media now, or that's how we know what we want to watch. I mean, and we're posting on social media, and I'll give you guys the handle here in a minute. Well, I'll give it to you right now. It's Bandwagon Podcast with no vowels. So just put all consonants in there, spell out Bandwagon Podcast, and you can follow us on Twitter. And all three of us try to post stuff there once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we each kind of have our areas. I'll post about soccer quite a bit. Posted the Muhammad Ali thing. These guys, the other two, they talk about baseball sometimes. But we're all in there. Hockey.
Yeah.
Get a little hockey in there.
Sure. Stanley Cup Finals going on.
So many sports right now. My goodness. We didn't even talk about soccer. That's fine. We'll get to it. We'll know more. All I have to say is that the United States men's national team are going to get their butts kicked by probably Costa Rica tonight. They look terrible.
Just cleaned their clock.
Oh, and they weren't even playing very well. The way that the United States – I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk about soccer, but just one thing. The way the United States men's team plays the game, and then you watch a game like last night, Chile and Argentina,
mm-hmm.
where it's so fun. It's just head-to-head. It's back and forth, up and down the field. Great passing. They try stuff. They're creative. You don't see any of that from the Americans. And it's like, what is – I don't know if it's coaching. They've never really been known for this – and it's for anything other than this like sort of almost Dutch style of sort of long ball, hope somebody's making a run, passing, formation kind of thing. You know, as my daughter pointed out, because she is my soccer expert at my house, my husband too. But she pointed out that a lot of teams sort of in the United States, they have a tendency to breed out creativity, but that the MLS is known for its like extra time goals. Mm-hmm. These are Americans. These aren't guys on the men's national team, but they are known for their extra time goals and crazy endings and just trying things desperately to score a goal. So I don't know what's going on with them, but I will be watching the match tonight, but I don't know. I don't know how they're going to do. Colombia, Hamas went out with a separated shoulder, I think. I think they popped it back in, but he looked kind of green when they put him back on the field afterwards. So I don't know if he's still good. But, yeah, they didn't even look that great, and they still just whooped him.
Not
what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And they get paid so much.
Well, and I guess the other thing is the U.S. team doesn't have to worry about the Olympics this year. So
yeah.
They didn't qualify.
Yes, that's true. And it's interesting because, like, when Brazil was playing the other night, I was like, hey, Neymar, he's not on the field. And Lily's like, he's playing in the Olympics. He's like 22 years old. He's like he's like one of the young guys on the roster. He's probably older than 22 now. He's probably 23 or 4. But still, it was funny to see. I always freak out when I see athletes in just like normal person clothes. Not even like, you know, in suits, that's one thing. But he was wearing like a tank top and shorts. I was like, he just looks like anybody now.
Just a dude.
It's just not cool. And his hair's normal. Right now he's in a normal stage. Anyway, so that's a little detour into soccer. Now I'm going to go into the credits. How's that sound?
Boom.
All right. So thank you from all two of us. We're minus John.
Well, soon, Steinbacher.
Yeah. For hopping onto the bandwagon this time around. Plenty of room for everyone, especially our guest today, Travis Tate. Better Tate than never. Thanks a lot, Travis, for joining us today. This podcast is produced by us, Lisa Braltz, John Steinbacher, when he's here, and Brian Moline. Brian records and edits everything. John and Lisa, or in this case, just me, Lisa. We hang out and talk. WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs is Scott Cameron. This podcast was his idea. Send him all of your grumpy emails about it. Jim Kelly designed our logo, and he also suggested our theme song, which is the song Bandwagon by the band REM. For now, you can find past episodes of The Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu. This is episode 16, by the way.
Sweet
16. As well as links to the articles we discussed, some show notes, videos. We'll have several links and things on the web once we get this episode ready. We're making some progress on a webpage still. I know I promise that every time. I should just stop talking about it. Like I mentioned, you can follow us at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, all the time, on Twitter. From there, you can stalk each of us individually if you're into that type of thing. All of our Twitter handles are there. The next episode of The Bandwagon will come your way in a couple of weeks. Will we have a podcast in iTunes?
Maybe.
But at least we're on Twitter, so, you know, have at it over there with us. We promise we'll respond to you. But, yeah, thanks again for listening.
See you.